See you tonight, I said to Mia, smiling and giving her arm a little squeeze. With 15 minutes left before work let out, Ted asked me to clean up some spilled coffee by aisle 12. I grabbed a broom from the maintenance room and headed over, but just as I began to mop the floor, I looked over and saw Kara headed in my direction. She was holding packs of sugar and creamer, but at the sight of me, they slipped out of her arms. I immediately dropped the mop and rushed over to help her.
It's okay, you don't have to, she said in a hurried voice.
Kara, seriously, let me help, it's okay, I told her. She allowed me to help, though she seemed a bit tense.
I'm sorry, Flynn, she said.
You shouldn't be apologizing at all, I interrupted. Look, I'm really sorry about what happened last week, I explained, trying to sound as honest as possible. I didn't mean to walk in on you. There was just so much going on, and I didn't realize what you were doing, you know?
I know, Flynn. I didn't mean to scream at you either.
Kara looked down at her boots like an embarrassed child.
Friends? She said.
She looked up and stuck out her hand. Friends, I said with a smile. We shook, then we both stood up, and I helped her bring the fallen packets to the counter. After I finished cleaning up the spilled coffee, I returned to the maintenance room to deposit the mop. Frank was there in the dark room, next to a mop bucket, throwing a banana peel into the garbage can.
Whoa, hey, Frank. What's up, Floater?
Hey, I forgot to ask, how did it go with Rachel? I said.
Oh, man, I called her and told her to meet me for dinner on Thursday and she was super into it, he smiled. I'm fucking her then, I bet.
Sure, okay, whatever, dude, I said. Hey, Frank, I was wondering if you would tell me more about how you would rob the store.
Why?
He suspiciously asked.
Oh, I'm just curious. Your imagination is wild, dude,
I added with a laugh, trying to seem like I was only interested for fun. Frank paused and then began spilling out words.
Well, the .357 Magnum Smith & Wesson in my locker would be a go-to for the job. I mean, with the...
What?
I said. You really do have a gun in your locker? What's wrong with you?
The question isn't what's wrong with me, my dear Flynn. It's what's wrong with the sick fuck who walks in here with a tool forged for death and a taste for revenge. I don't know if you've realized, but this world is fucked up, man. And if we're at work and some fucking psycho walks through that door, one of us has to be prepared, you know what I'm saying?
Again, it was one of those moments where Frank's insane logic somehow kind of made sense. I glanced at the clock. Fuck, it was 5:45 and I was supposed to meet Mia in 15 minutes. I asked him if we could postpone the tale of how he would rob the store for another time. With that, I went to the break room, clocked out, put my apron in my locker, and headed home. Once I got home, I realized I had forgotten to feed Bennett in the morning, so I put a cup of dog food in his bowl. I grabbed his blue leash, clamped it to his collar, and took him for a quick walk. I loved walking Bennett after work because it gave me time to decompress and think about my day and how it related to my novel. I would write notes, sketching out scenes and dialogue. For how boring work was, it was at least serving its purpose of giving me good material for the book. Bennett stopped to piss. I waited for him to finish his business and tied him to the bench. My nose was in my notebook like never before, jotting down things about Rachel, Frank, and our conversation on the roof, the revolver in his locker, and his crackpot notions of robbing the store. While writing, I heard a very familiar voice. Hey there, handsome. I looked up, and Mia was a few feet away heading in my direction. I grinned from ear to ear.
What are you doing?
Oh, I was just walking my... I looked down, and there was the end of the leash, but no dog. Bennett was gone. My stomach dropped.
Bennett! Bennett!
I yelled. Oh no, he must have gotten loose from his collar when I wasn't looking.
Oh my God, Flynn, I'm sorry,
she said, examining the end of the leash that still had the part that clips on the red collar. It was perfectly intact.
I wonder how he slipped out.
I don't know, but let's go look for him, quick.
We spent the next hour searching everywhere. I'd wanted a dog my entire life, and when I finally got one, we instantly bonded. Bennett was my main companion. He kept me sane. He really was a best friend, and now he was gone. I felt helpless, but there was nothing more to be done. So we decided to head back to my apartment with the hope that he may have returned. When we reached the front door, any optimism I had vanished.
Mia held my hand sweetly as I opened the door, and we made our way up the stairwell and into my apartment. After sliding my key in the hole and twisting the knob, we were in.
"Look, I know this sucks," Mia said, "but I'm sure he'll come back soon, and you might not want to hear it, but worrying won't do you any good, baby."
Looking into her beautiful brown eyes, I knew she was right. Just then, she peered over my shoulder to my record collection.
"Oh, wow, Destroyer," she said, moving toward the couch and my records. "I love him. He's so weird and different."
I told her I felt exactly the same way. "Have you heard Poison Season?" I asked.
"Of course," she responded.
"Have you heard 5 Spanish songs?" I smiled and looked down.
"Yeah, I mean, I heard it, but I didn't exactly understand it given the language barrier and all."
We both laughed. She was getting excited, saying how Destroyer's Rubies was their best record. We were nerding out hard. I'd never found a girl who was so on my level with music.
"Do you listen to Tame Impala?" she asked.
"Nah, never heard of them," I said, shaking my head.
"You're kidding me! You haven't listened to Currents?" she yelled.
"Nah, I haven't. Is it any good?"
She stared blankly at me. "Is it any good? Is it any good?" he says. "It's amazing, Flynn. A true modern classic. I'll have to grab you a copy from the Vinyl Village."
"Oh, I love that place," I exclaimed, grabbing a 12-inch from the middle of the pile. I carefully freed the vinyl from its sleeve and set it on the record player, dropping the needle into the groove. "Have you ever heard this gem?" The music spilled softly from the speakers. "This one's called Yeah Right from Toro y Moi's album What For," I said. The lamp in the corner of the room dimly lit the right side of her body as she hugged herself, smiling and swaying side to side, her eyes closed.
"Mmm,"
she said as if she had just bitten into her grandmother's freshly baked chocolate chip cookies.
"I like this one," she whispered.
The sun was setting outside the window, the clouds cascading into another vanilla sky. This reminded me of the lighter Frank had secretly returned to Curtis.
"Toro y Moi, he's really special," I told her.
"I love his stuff. I wish I could make music like this. Hell, music in general," I thought out loud. "That would be just amazing." She opened her eyes and put her arms around my shoulders, and we began to slow dance as if we were in junior high.
"You can do anything you want," she said.
"Yes, you're right, but I suppose I have other ambitions."
"Other ambitions? You mean to tell me you don't want to work in a grocery store forever?"
she said with a smile.
"Of course not," I said.
"Why are you there then?" she continued.
"You seem like you don't belong. You seem, I don't know, destined for something bigger."
I wanted to tell her everything. I wanted to tell her about the book, about Frank, about how I was falling for her. But I felt paralyzed. I felt as though I couldn't say anything. She laid her head on my chest as we swayed to the song's BPM.
"Whatever you want to do, whatever you sense deep down, I know you'll be incredible at it, Flynn."
The song stopped and the needle picked itself up and idly hovered, waiting for another record. I let the silence fill the room, then grabbed a very special one from the back of my box of records. I dropped the needle. As the crackle from the rotating disc echoed through my apartment, I grabbed Mia, my right hand on her hip, the other interlocked with hers as we began to sway slowly. Her head rested on my chest. I was scared she would feel my heart beating, racing at the thought of kissing her, even though at this point I already had several times. Every time with her was like the first time. "I'll be the one that stays till the end, and I'll be the one who needs you again. And I'll be the one that proposes in a garden of roses and truly loves you long after our curtain closes," I sang under my breath to the music.
"This is beautiful, Flynn. What is it?" she asked.
She went from using my chest as a pillow to resting her chin on it, staring up at me, our lips inches apart. "This one's called Happiness by Rex Orange County," I told her.
It's fitting," she said with that smile I knew all too well.
"And why's that?" I asked.
"Because I'm the happiest I've ever been when I'm with you," she said.
Just as I tried to utter something romantic, she kissed me, and the world stopped. With her, there was no derealization, no anxiety, no book,
No Frank, just us. The rest of the night seemed to consist of her in my arms, perfect music and laughter. It was a night I'd never forget. That night I knew I loved her. Chapter 9. Currents. In the following weeks, Mia and I grew closer than ever. I even introduced her to my mother. My mom and I hadn't seen a whole lot of each other since I moved out, but not because we didn't want to. Outside of Bennett and Mia, my mom was my rock, always had been. I told her I needed to engulf myself in work and knock out the book, which she completely understood. I also needed some space and independence after living with her into my 20s. She wasn't the happiest about not seeing me as often, but she was happy when I broke the rule one evening by bringing Mia over to meet her. The two naturally took to each other, and after a long night of endless baby pictures, Mia fell asleep on my mom's couch. That's when my mom told me she had a very special feeling about her and not to fuck it up, as she put it. Honestly, Mia was my only hope for humanity. She was so sweet. All in all, things were great, aside from the unfortunate fact that Bennett hadn't returned. I stapled posters around my neighborhood with the only picture of us, the one we took together outside the dog shelter. Staring at the picture of my hand on his head, his tongue sticking out, made me sad. It was so strange that he had just disappeared. Even stranger was the look on people's faces when I showed them the picture. They looked at me like I was some asshole bothering them about nothing. One guy even said, "Are you fucking kidding me, buddy? How could people be such dicks about a lost dog?" I still had hope he'd return. I called the Humane Society and told all my neighbors. Bennett was too smart to just leave like that. He was certainly smarter than Frank. Back at the store, Frank elaborated on his hypothetical scheme to rob it. He said he knew all the entrances and exits to avoid detection. He knew the blind spots, the security codes, and the sequence for the safe. He was pretty cocky about the whole thing. It was great for me because he was giving me the details for the biggest scene in my book. In the same monologue, he had told me about his time with Rachel, especially the sex they'd had. I felt a little uncomfortable knowing all this private stuff about Rachel, but I was intrigued, as one naturally is. He said she was a freak who was into role-playing and restraints. Landlord and tenant, boss and employee, handcuffs, chokers, whips. Apparently, she would throw on a black leather latex catsuit, real 50 shades of gray shit. Frank must have been an all-right lover, because every time I saw Rachel, she no longer had that permanent resting bitch face. She was all perky and smiling now. I remember the first day Frank told me he had had sex with her. We were walking down aisle 7, and sure enough, there she was, walking in our direction. "Hi, Frank," she said, giving a wink as she passed by. It was pretty weird to see her with this new insider knowledge. I guess I could see it. It had been 3 weeks since that amazing night at my place listening to music with Mia. Wait! Oh, shit! How could I have left out the fact that we had sex? It was amazing. It happened the week after that night. We had another great date and wound up back at my crib. At her request, we put on Toro y Moi. One thing led to another, and we were making out heavy on my couch. She took her shirt off and, to my surprise, wasn't wearing a bra. She was stunning. She had perfect B-cup breasts. It made me feel good that she felt comfortable enough with me to do that. Things were getting hot. I was kissing her neck and she grabbed my hands and pressed them into her breasts. I asked her if I could go down on her and she nodded yes. After several intense minutes of that, she told me she wanted me. I asked her if she wanted to have sex and she said yes. She took off her jeans and grabbed my face, kissing me. She arched her waist and straddled me, slowly sitting down. I'll leave it at that, but shit, it was really incredible. She was so sweet and cute and into it. She told me what she wanted and asked me what I wanted. She satisfied all my needs, and assuming that she wasn't lying when I asked, I satisfied hers as well. It was mind-blowing, and that wasn't the last time that night either. Things couldn't have been going any better between us. And to top all that off, it was like I'd never known what writer's block was. I was in a groove with my novel, like never before. It was coming out of me with total ease, like breathing. I'd pace around my room, bouncing my red rubber ball. The neighbors underneath me must have hated my guts, but the words were just flowing out of me. It almost felt manic, because the setting of Muldoon's was a fictionalized version of the real Muldoon's. The whole thing felt like second nature. They say write what you know. Couldn't have been any truer in this case. I was weaving Rhonda and Ted and Rachel and Frank and Curtis and the whole gang into the book, under different names, of course. Because I lived it, my novel felt incredibly real to me. Art imitates life. Life imitates art. Was my novel too close to reality? I was a little concerned about what all my coworkers would think when they read the book and they encountered thinly veiled versions of themselves. I figured I would write the robbery scene on the evening of the 27th, the day before Vernon picked up the cash deposit from Hector, the security guard. It felt more authentic to write this way. That's when the robbery would most logically happen in real life. I'd be able to write it like a reporter would. It'd be more vivid and alive that way. For example, I made Frank call me every time he and Rachel went out. They would hang, hit the movies, fuck, get something to eat, and then he would tell me exactly how it happened. Like when they had sex after the movie, in the goddamn theater. Like Jesus. It made me appreciate what I had with Mia. Frank and Rachel were pure animals, just constantly having sex and being sarcastic and negative about life. Mia and I had depth. We loved to do things together. Talk, ride bikes, grab lunch, hit the bookstore, play catch. She played softball in high school, so she had a pretty good arm. There's nothing sexier than a sporty girl. Oh, and of course, shot for records at Fisher's Vinyl Village. The guys who worked there were like if the cast of Clerks face-fucked Superbad. They were always out of it, especially the owner, Fisher. That dude definitely did a lot of drugs in his day. Straight acid head burnout. But one thing's for sure, they had an amazing selection of music. Anything you could imagine, they stocked it. Except for Tame Impala's Currents. Guess it was that much in demand. One night I was waiting for Frank to call me and tell me about his time with Rachel. Mia and I didn't talk much on the days they went out, because I would need to be home to write. I'd give excuses as to why we couldn't hang that night. All the while, I would be at my typewriter writing about what Frank and Rachel were currently doing. Frank would tell me exactly what his plans were for the night. Then, when he called to explain what happened on the date, I could pick and choose between fact and fiction. Basically, I wrote what I thought would be intriguing to the reader, and then I'd pepper whatever actually happened into my story, making it more believable. Frank obviously hadn't robbed the grocery, but he had given me an outlandish scenario for how he would execute it, and I'd taken notes. The scene was going to be realistic as hell. Every night, Frank went out with Rachel. I would write and wait for his call, but tonight was different. I sat down at my writing desk and noticed an unopened envelope. The return address was Darjeeling Publishing. Shit. I opened it up. Dear Flynn, I hope you're well. I just wanted to check in on your progress. I know you've been hard at work, but I also know life happens. I want you to know that I'm here to support you, but I'm also here to remind you that your deadline for turning in your finished manuscript is right around the corner. Remember, we have a deal, a contract, and I need to get this out into the market soon. We've got high hopes for it. This freaked me out. I was almost to the climax, but I was far from having it in a place for my publisher to read. I started to type out a response. Hi, Ed. I'm making fantastic progress and am definitely on track to meet the deadline. I'm excited for you to read it. I think it's my best work. It's really a special... An aggressive knock interrupted me. It sounded like a cop's knock. Nervous about the banging on the door, I tiptoed over and looked through the peephole. It was Mia. What the fuck was she doing here? I told her I had to help my mom move furniture at home. She knocked again. Flynn, she said, are you in there? Oh shit, I thought to myself. I was in the middle of writing and waiting for Frank's call, and it was very important as he would give me a needed last bit of information regarding Rachel. Flynn! Mia seemed upset, maybe even unsure, I couldn't tell. One moment, I said through the door, then quickly ran through my living room picking up all the papers I had written on about Rachel. Flynn, open this door! Mia yelled as I did my best to shove everything into a drawer under my typewriter. Scrambling, I fixed my shirt and opened the door. Mia immediately pushed past me and into the apartment. Flynn, she said suspiciously, what are you doing? Why are you being so sketchy? What do you mean? I asked, not quite sure what she meant. Have you been out tonight, Flynn? I had no idea what she thought was going on. I haven't been anywhere, I told her. I've been chilling here. What are you getting at? She set her bag down. You tell me, Flynn. Tell you what, Mia? Oh, I don't know. The random days and nights you ignore me? The lame excuse you gave me about how you needed time to yourself? She looked almost betrayed. Wait,
What do you think is going on? I asked, confused.
Just admit it, Flynn. You're cheating on me. I had my suspicions, but I tried to push them away. I didn't want to trust my gut because when you look into my eyes and say the things you do, I want to believe you. I want to trust you. I felt like I could, but I've been cheated on before, and I know all the signs. It's so obvious. What a foolish girl I am, she said, heading for the door. I grabbed her arm.
Wait, Mia, please. Whatever you think is going on obviously isn't, I said.
Obviously, Mia repeated sarcastically. I wasn't trying to be the crazy girlfriend, the needy girlfriend, all clingy and annoying. I told myself the days you spent to yourself, well, you must have been doing something special, working on yourself, something that would get you out of that fucking supermarket. And then I find out from Curtis that you're...
Wait, I interrupted. What the fuck does Curtis have to do with anything? I was suddenly pissed.
I find out from Curtis that you're cheating on me.
As she said the words, Mia burst into tears.
What?
I asked with such unfathomable incomprehension that there was laughter beneath my words, even a slight smirk.
Frank was right, I said. Curtis does fucking like you. Baby, this guy is lying to you. He obviously has feelings for you and is trying to sabotage what we have, okay?
Mia ripped her arm from my grip.
Frank, 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 Frank. Is he all you care about? You seem to think about this guy more than me. Why are you so secretive, Flynn? Why can't I meet your best friend?
Don't try to change the subject, I yelled. Curtis obviously has feelings for you. Why would you believe that joker over me, Mia?
He told me he was walking past the record shop, and he saw you and Rachel in there, kissing, in our place. I couldn't believe it when he told me.
Her tears were falling faster than ever.
Baby, I would never do that. It's me, okay? It's me, Mia. I mean, I fucking love...
I stopped myself quickly, but it was too late. Instantly, Mia's eyes changed. She looked confused, dismayed, scared, and a little stunned. Her tears subsided.
You what, Flynn?
No going back now.
I love you, Mia. Flynn, fuck you. You don't love me. You're fucking some random girl at work, she said.
Mia, listen to me. I would never think of it. I love you. I know Curtis. Unfortunately, he's a bitter man-child who gets off on trying to ruin people's lives. He likes you and he wants to see us fail. That's why he's making up absurd lies. Trust me, baby. I love you. I would never hurt you like that. I'm sorry you've been hurt in the past, but that doesn't mean that all men are amoral assholes. Let me love you, I said.
She looked into my eyes, cracking a smile. She hugged me the hardest she ever had. Oh, Flynn, I love you too. I'm sorry, I guess I've just been in my own head, you know? This time you've been spending alone has just gotten to me because I never met anyone like you. And I love spending time together. I think I've fallen for you harder than I thought. I get paranoid because of what my shitty ex-boyfriend did. He was fucking some girl for 6 months before I found out. I'm sorry I rushed to conclusions.
Wow, I love you, Flynn. I can't believe I'm breaking down that wall. I love you, and I really want to...
She stopped suddenly. Slowly, she began moving away from me. Here I was, beaming, thinking it was time to rejoice, until her pained gaze ripped that smile right from my face. She looked even more hurt than before. She pushed me away, tears falling and head shaking as she pulled out part of a piece of paper protruding from my desk drawer. Already in mid-read, she continued, eyes glued to the text as she pulled it free. I immediately knew what she was reading. She was reading a scene from my novel about Frank and Rachel, written from Frank's perspective. Worse still, it was a sex scene. Rachel was a pro? Her pussy was the best I've ever had? Mia read out loud. The wettest my dick had ever been? I would watch her ass bouncing in the mirror? She could get it, and she did? I couldn't believe it.
No, baby, it's not what you think, I said desperately.
It's not what I think? Well, Flynn, what the fuck am I supposed to think? You're keeping a badly written sex diary about the girl you're cheating on me with? The man I just professed my love for lied to me when he told me he loved me. Obviously, he doesn't love me if he's fucking some other girl from work. I see how she looks at you, Flynn. I'm not stupid. And you know what? It all makes sense now.
You pieces of shit deserve each other, she screamed. I grabbed her by the arm again, desperate to explain. Mia, I'm writing a novel, I admitted. I told her everything. I had to. This was my last chance at salvaging this relationship. I told her I had a book deal. I told her I was working at Muldoon's because I needed a normal place to base my novel on. I explained that I was basing my main character on Frank, and that Rachel had been with Frank, not me. I told her that the only thing that would get me out of the supermarket was this novel. I told her that's why I was ignoring her, that I needed time at home to get this novel done, that my publisher kept bugging me about turning it in. I poured my heart out about how Lola dumped me because I never finished any writing projects, that I was depressed and felt broken, and that creating this piece of work was the only thing that was bringing me peace besides her. I told her about my terrifying feelings of derealization. I told her how that feeling had ceased with her. No matter what, she had to believe me. She had to understand it was all for my book. She stared at me, unsure whether to trust the conviction in my voice or smack me for thinking she was stupid enough to believe this. And just then, the phone rang. Instantly, I knew it was Frank, and I knew that Frank would be able to set all this straight. Even though I hadn't told him about the novel, he would at least be able to tell her it was he who had hooked up with Rachel. The phone, it's ringing. It's Frank. That's when Mia gave me a look she had never given me before. Complete horror. She stared at the phone as I picked it up. Frank, Frank, you gotta help me. Mia's here right now and she thinks that I've been with Rachel. Please, Frank, tell her that it's you who's been with her. With that, I handed Mia the phone. She shook her head no, eyes wider than ever. What do you mean? Take the phone, baby, please. He can tell you the truth. Finally, she extended her shaking hand, gripped the phone, and raised it to her ear. A few seconds later, as if she'd been told everything she suspected was true, she dropped the phone. Tears continued to fall. Please leave me alone, she said, walking backward toward the door. Don't ever come near me again, Flynn. Her voice was cold, distant, and definitive. What do you mean? What are you talking about? Don't you ever fucking come near me again! The door slammed shut. I stood frozen, staring at the closed door. Beside it was a bag she had left. Peeking out was a psychedelic-looking 12-inch that read, Tame Impala, Currents. It had a note taped to it. Flynn, I hope you love this record as much as I love you. XOXO, Mia. I started to cry, thinking of who I had just lost. But then the tears stopped. I started to feel numb. My head felt cloudy. My stomach hurt. I couldn't think. I felt like I was floating out of my body. I leaped for the phone. Frank, Frank, are you there? A few seconds later, I heard chewing. Frank eating yet another banana, I was sure. Frank, what the fuck did you say to her? There was a pause. Nothing, man, Frank said nonchalantly. What did you tell her, Frank? I yelled, holding the phone out in front of me. Nothing, Flynn, Frank yelled back. Don't you fuck with me. Outraged and unable to think clearly, I kept going. What did you tell her on the phone? Another pause, then Frank finally spoke. What she needed to hear. And the line was dead. Chapter 10, Climactic Event. I was at a loss. As I saw it, there was no way to recover. 2 days passed and Frank didn't come into work. I kept my distance from Rachel as I didn't know if she was in on whatever Frank had been up to. For all I knew, she would try to cause a scene in front of Mia, making it look as though something was actually happening between us. It was like the fucking Twilight Zone. The whole place had changed. It was a radioactive toxic zone now. As for Mia, well, she was still coming to work, but I couldn't bear to speak to her. I almost wanted to quit to avoid the whole situation. Every time I tried to muster up the courage, I just remembered the look in her eyes when she left me. I tried to stay to myself, which wasn't easy as a floater. I was feeling low. I'd find myself staring into the distance, zoned out. Outside the plate glass window, the old man sat, playing chess against himself. Walking through the aisles, I came across old Joe clutching his cup and repeating, "Coffee, coffee, coffee, coffee." Again. He hadn't missed a day since I had begun to work there. And then, of course, there was Anne with the multivitamins, and as much as I wanted to bark at her to stay the fuck away from me, she was just so damn sweet, I couldn't bring myself to do it. Instead, I said hello with as big a smile I could, took the pills, pretended to pop them, and placed them, yet again, in the right pocket of my brown jacket. Under the weight of my own thoughts, I headed to the loading dock to get away from things. I needed some fresh air. On my way there, I passed by the deli. Curtis was smiling, a mocking smile that came with a side of pride. By now, he had gotten wind of me and Mia's breakup. A breakup I know he caused because he had feelings for her. I wanted to bash his head in, but in that moment I remained calm. I didn't act, I didn't do anything. I didn't even dream of doing so. I couldn't risk harming Curtis, or even verbally scolding him in the off chance it would get back to Mia. I just kept walking, making my way to the roof. I truly needed to clear my head, and there was no better place. The last time I had been up there was with Frank, when we discussed Curtis's lighter. I should have told him to never give it back to that fuck. I wanted to kill him for ruining my relationship with Mia. With that thought, I pulled out my wallet once more to stare at the picture of Lola and me. Why could I find love, but not keep it? I asked myself. And then I heard a voice in my head. Stop feeling sorry for yourself, pussy. It was in Frank's voice, of course. But Frank wasn't there. Frank had gotten so inside my head that he had become the devil on my shoulder, the one telling me to just do it. My better-thinking subconscious was the angel. But to be honest, this time, the devil was right. With that, I stared at the picture of Lola. I will finish this book. I will finish this book. I mean, that's what all this was about. It wasn't about Mia or falling in love or any of this other bullshit. It was about finishing something I started. It was about committing to something greater than myself, something bigger than me or Frank or Lola or Mia. It was about overcoming my fear of failure. It was about making myself complete through my art. It was about something unexplainable. The picture had become a burden, a weight I carried around at all times, a symbol of my inability to move forward. It had to go. I had to go. I needed to free myself. I took the picture and tore it in half. Then I tore it again. Lola was gone. And maybe so was Mia. It was time to rid myself of the things that were holding me back. It was time to do this on my own. Do it my way. I threw the shredded picture over the side of the building. The pieces fell gently like leaves in the wind, rocking to and fro as they approached the ground. It was nearly 7, which meant I was off. Off to finish the last chapter in my book. I would give it that final, climactic event. In about 5 hours' time, my main character was going to rob the very grocery store I was standing on top of. I had to prepare. On the way home, I stopped by the liquor store and grabbed a bottle of Macallan, Frank's favorite single malt scotch. At least, that's what my notes said. My moleskin had so many entries I couldn't remember half of what I'd written down. Good thing, too, because it helped me with the details and nuances about the characters. Articles of clothing, facial features, mannerisms, voice tics, surroundings, weather, and just about anything else I needed to create a real, moving, spinning world for readers to lose themselves in. After grabbing the booze, I stopped at the thrift shop to snag a ski mask and duffel bag. If I was going to do this, I was really going to play the part. Fuck method acting. This was method writing. Back at my apartment, I prepped my typewriter and poured a glass of scotch. I took a shot. Fuck that, I thought to myself, then threw the glass. It shattered on the floor. Frank would drink it straight from the bottle. I opened the Tame Impala record that Mia had left at my place and put it on my turntable. I set the needle down. As the crackle from the record echoed through my apartment, I looked at my attire. Black jeans, black shoes, black t-shirt, an empty black duffel bag on the floor to the left of my chair. Ski mask in hand. New person, same old mistakes by Tame Impala blasted through my apartment. I was ready. Frank was ready. I put my hands on my typewriter, closed my eyes, and began to type. Frank strutted up to the closed grocery store. With every word I wrote, Every step I spelled out on the page, Frank followed. I could feel the energy. This would be the most propulsive scene I'd ever written. I was fully in the character's head. I was Frank. I was robbing the store. As I sat in my chair, I pulled down my ski mask, as did Frank. I took a swig from my bottle of scotch, and Frank took a swig from outside the front doors of the grocery store. Then Frank wielded a giant metal baseball bat and swung furiously at the front sliding glass door, shattering it. Walking in with no regard for the law, Frank strolled from aisle to aisle, picking out snacks at will. He opened a bag of chips, ate one, and threw the rest away. I took a swig, he took a swig. Over by the self-serving bulk candies, he grabs a handful of jelly beans and throws them in the air above his head one by one, aiming for his mouth. He strolls over to the produce department, grabs a banana, and begins to peel it. Twirling his small black duffel bag, he heads over to a shelf of pasta sauce, grabs a jar, tosses it in the air, and swings, connecting bat to glass for an explosion of red sauce across the aisle floor. Moving to the front of the store, he stops in the middle of aisle 12. The fluorescent lights flickering in and out just like they always do. With all his might, he kicks the entire shelf, tipping it over. It collides with the shelves in aisle 11, which repeats in aisle 10, all the way down to aisle 6, like dominoes, where they come crashing down with immeasurable force. With half of the aisles in the store demolished on the ground, Frank cracks a smile, continuing his walk to the front of the store. Smashing the vending machine open, he retrieves the payday he'd been eyeing. "What kind of grocery store has a vending machine in it?" he snickers, then continues on his way. Arriving at customer service, where Rhonda is usually stationed, Frank swigs from the bottle because I, in my apartment, do the same. Hot, I remove the mask, wipe the sweat from my brow, and pull it back down over my face. Drunk, my fingers begin to move slower than usual along the typewriter keys. Frank jumps the customer service desk and slides across it like it's the roof of a sports car. Landing his feet flat on the ground, he knows what he needs to do next. He needs to break through the door in front of him, into Hector's security room. He needs to rewind the tapes and then press record, so none of what he did would be caught on camera by the security monitors. The tapes would go from a perfectly fine, ordered store straight to the aftermath, straight chaos. There would be no explanation of how it happened. After fixing the tapes, he would retrieve the money and be on his way. Frank kicks in the door, revealing the inside of the security room. It's illuminated by bright screens displaying a live video feed of the entire store. To the right of the monitors, on the floor under a desk, he sees a safe. He knows what to do. Frank ducks down and locates the keypad. A small, square, red light above the three on the keypad signifies it's locked. Frank plants his left knee onto the floor, removes his black duffel bag from around his shoulder, and downs the rest of his scotch, throwing the bottle, watching it shatter. My bottle, however, does not shatter. To the right of my typewriter, it sits in perfect condition, still half full. As if he'd set the code himself, Frank smoothly dials in 34652. A shrill, high-pitched tone sounds off, the red square above the three on the keypad quickly turning green. The safe pops open. Frank grabs the safe door and opens it, revealing it's empty. Nah, I'm just fucking with you. It's completely packed to the brim with ones, fives, tens, twenties, fifties, and $100 bills, money orders, and checks payable to Muldoon's Grocery. From what Frank can tell, there's damn near $200,000 in there. With that, he puts the money in his duffel bag, laughing at how easy it was to pull the whole thing off. At the same time, I sit there in my apartment thinking about exactly how I should end this part of the book. In my book, Frank had planned to rob the store. He always had the idea of robbing Muldoon's blind and running off to Canada, just the way Frank had told me in real life. He knew the store had no alarm system, just the fire sprinklers, which would automatically alert firefighters to the police station in case of an emergency. Nobody would know what had happened until morning. Frank takes his time collecting the money, savoring the process. Once he has it all, he stands up and reaches into his pocket, pulling out a single cigarette and the silver Zippo he had stolen. He lights the cigarette through the hole in his ski mask and strolls to the front of the store. Now, originally, I was going to write it that he had erased the videotapes. But in that moment, sitting behind my typewriter, something overcame me. I decided to end my novel another way. As he steps in front of the shattered glass of the automatic doors at the entrance, he looks up into the camera and rips the ski mask from his face. Staring into the lens, he flips off Ted Daniels and everyone else who would be walking into the store the following day. Everyone who would review the tapes would see it was him. And he doesn't care, because he will be long gone, already at the Canadian border with Rachel. Frank looks over his shoulder to take one last look at the supermarket and the havoc he's wreaked. He walks outside, opens the passenger door of a red Mazda RX-7, throws the bag inside, jumps in, kisses Rachel, and drives into the darkness, never to be seen again. As though he had never been seen all along. The end. Chapter 11. The End. I had ended my novel. In a moment of exasperation, my head collapsed onto my typewriter. The next morning, I awoke, hungover, to the crackle of a needle spinning at the end of a record. I had fallen asleep at my desk. I lifted my head, revealing the letters RDFGTVCSEGHAZXQ&W on the side of my face. I saw all the tools I'd used to accomplish what I had: ski mask, black jeans, t-shirt, and a bottle of Macallan. I had never written anything in such a manner before. Actually dressing up and truly writing from the perspective of my novel's protagonist, it had felt so right, like hardcore literature, like fieldwork for an author. Wow, I thought, I'm an author. I'm a real-life author. Then I looked at my watch and saw the time. Oh, shit, I said aloud. I was late. That day I had the earliest shift and was supposed to be there by 8:45 for the doors, which opened at 9 a.m. It was 8:50. I hurriedly changed into a white undershirt but tripped over the duffel bag. Once on my feet, I changed and ran down the stairwell of my apartment building, heading toward Muldoon's. It was 9:01 when I arrived, so I entered through the side door of the break room, the one that was open during business hours. As soon as I walked in, I went to my locker to clock in and put on my brown button-down and black apron. When I opened it, I noticed a few things I hadn't before, and my eyes grew wide in realization of what was in front of me. It was Frank's .357 Magnum, a pack of cigarettes, and Curtis's silver Zippo lighter. At first, I was angry that Frank would put these items in my locker, but then I wondered, how the fuck had he gotten the code to my lock? I pushed down on the metal bottom inside the locker, and sure enough, Frank was right. There was a hidden cubby. I put the items inside and quickly shut the locker. Flynn! I jumped at the sound of my own name. When I turned, I saw Ted Daniels, and he wasn't smiling. What's wrong? I asked. Come with me, he said. He rushed me outside. We moved into a circle with Rhonda, Curtis, Mia, Becca, Rachel, a few other employees I didn't really know, and Frank.
This is very, very unfortunate, said Ted Daniels. Someone robbed the store last night. The police are here now reviewing the tapes. Whoever the culprit might be, at least we'll get a good glimpse of what happened.
I wonder who it was, Frank said to me with a wink and a smirk. The kind of smirk that said, I did it.
Oh my God, you guys, did someone get shot? Said Kara, who had just walked through the front door.
There's like a million cop cars out front, she added, stepping over the broken glass.
Somebody robbed the store, Frank replied.
I was staring at him so hard that it seemed to make Rachel, who was next to him, uncomfortable.
How could you do this, Frank? I whispered to him.
Because I wanted the money, he whispered back.
That's not what I mean. How could you lie to Mia on the phone? How could you ruin my relationship with her? She thinks I had sex with Rachel.
Rachel, who had heard her name in the conversation, peered over, as did Mia.
Why the fuck would she think that? Frank said.
It's not important, I said.
All that matters is that you go over there and make it right, I said, beginning to raise my voice.
What are you talking about, Flynn? Why are you yelling?
Mia asked me. This was the first time Mia had spoken to me since she slammed my door.
You know what, Flynn? Frank said. You're such a pussy, man. You brought this on yourself. It's not my fault you can't keep a woman. No wonder Lola left you. What did you say? I yelled.
By then, everyone in the area was staring at me. You work in a supermarket, man. You're a nobody, and you always will be. You're a nobody, bro, Frank said, then kept repeating it. You might think I'm a nobody, but you don't even fucking exist. The entire store went quiet. My head began to feel heavy. My vision blurred. I couldn't breathe. I started to see double. I stared at Frank. The outlines of his body began to radiate out. He started to flicker. He disappeared, then reappeared. Frank tried to speak. You pussy. You're never going to finish that. His voice trailed off and cut out altogether. And that instant it hit me. Everything came back to me. Frank wasn't real. And I don't mean he wasn't real and that he had no substance as a human being. I mean, he wasn't a human being. He was a made-up delusion, a false character I had created in a desperate attempt to realize my novel. The mind was a powerful thing, terrifyingly powerful, powerful enough to convince you that a character of your own invention was real. I was forcing myself to finish this book by any means necessary. I had allowed my imagination to fully take over for a greater cause. It all made sense now.
Flynn, what are you talking about? Asked Mia.
This guy has issues, said Curtis.
Fuck you, Curtis, I screamed. I exist.
What the fuck are you talking about, Flynn? Said Frank with an uneasiness in his voice.
Well, Frank, I said with a cocky attitude, I hate to break it to you, but I created you to help me finish my book. You're a tool. You're something I utilize for the sake of creativity and nothing more. I finished in a loud voice, smiling.
What about all the girls I fucked? Frank said desperately. That never happened, I retorted.
I fed into the delusion so much I forgot what I had done. I first gained knowledge of what you really were after I walked in on Kara topless, I explained, pointing to Kara.
Hey,
she said, flushing red and looking around with embarrassment. You said you fucked her and that she had a cupcake tattoo under her left breast, I told him, right above her rib cage, but she didn't. And I knew then that you were fake. I could see right through you. I could see you for what you really were, or what you weren't. You were just something I made up to help me finish my novel about a guy who works in a supermarket. Frank looked around, desperate, struck with panic.
None of what you're saying makes sense. I'm real, Flynn, he said.
Then tell me your last name, I said.
What's your last name, huh?
Frank stared down at the floor, then up at me about to answer, and paused.
You can't tell me your last name because I haven't written it down yet.
I'm real, Frank yelled.
I'm so real.
Then tell me your last name, Frank, I demanded. Once more, Frank went to reply, paused, looked at the ground, then back at me, puzzled.
I'm the king of this place. I've slayed so many of the college bitches who have come out of here, he said in a panic.
That's not true, Frank. I've disproven that.
What about Rachel? Frank asked.
I know I've bent the truth on other girls, okay? I admit it. But I've been fucking Rachel's brains out for like a month, he said, desperate to prove himself.
I hate to break it to you, I said, but the only way you could technically have had sex with Rachel is if I had sex with Rachel. And I most certainly have never, ever had sex with Rachel.
How can you say that? Rachel said, speaking up. Did our time together mean nothing to you?
I fucking knew it, yelled Mia, storming off.
You're sick in the head, man, said Curtis before chasing after Mia. And right then, what started out as a cocky realization ended in another realization. I had been arguing with a man who didn't exist in the middle of the supermarket. This meant I did cheat on Mia. Those nights I sat writing on my typewriter about what Frank and Rachel had been doing, I was actually living those moments myself and writing about them later. How much had I tricked my brain? How much had my brain tricked me? I looked to my side. Frank began to fizzle, looking staticky like bad reception on an old school television. My chest grew insanely tight. I felt like I couldn't remember where I was or who I was. Time seemed to slow down, then speed up. It felt like I was in a waking dream. And in a matter of seconds, everything came back to me. Every moment I blocked out of my mind. Every time I lied to myself for the sake of completing my book suddenly revealed itself. I felt piercingly lucid. It all started with Bennett. I pulled out the photo of me and my dog. There was no dog in the photo. Bennett didn't exist. I went to the shelter, imagined a dog in an empty cage, bought him food, a red collar, and a blue leash.
I asked a guy to take a picture of my dog and me, and he freaked out because there was no animal by my side. He must have thought I was a crazy person. Oh my God, I thought in this instant of realization. Have I been a crazy person? Oh no. All those walks after work with Bennett, I had just been dragging around a leash, posting photos of a lost dog with no dog in it, asking people if they had seen him, showing them nothing. No wonder that guy asked me if I was fucking kidding. And then the repressed memories started to pour out, unlocking all at once. Frank never said anything to Mia on the phone that night. He didn't tell her I was fucking Rachel. He told her nothing. There was no Frank to say anything. When I claimed the phone was ringing and Frank was on the line, she knew something was wrong, because not only did the phone never ring, not only was there no one on the other line, the phone wasn't even plugged into the wall. Oh my God, it was all so twisted to realize. This meant when Rachel walked down the aisle towards us, winked, and said hello to Frank, she actually meant me, because I had been Frank all along. Of course, when I received Rachel's number, I put it in my right pocket, but retrieved it from my left pocket when giving it to him. I had only done it for the action of doing so inside the delusion. There'd been no reason to hand it over to Frank because I was Frank. Frank was me. I made Frank up and made him real in my own head. He was a complete illusion, a hallucination, an apparition. It went all the way back to that first day at Muldoon's when he thanked me for being the only person who acknowledges my existence in this place. In mid-panic, I fell to my knees, scared to death. I tried to run, but was disoriented. And every time I tried again, I fell over from a spell of vertigo. It felt like slamming into the cashier's conveyor belt. Then I noticed all the shelves from aisles 6 through 12 were on the ground, essentially destroyed. The sight of this only confused me more. As I struggled to get up to my feet, something stopped me. Someone. I was being held by my neck by a large man in a dark room, looking into a bright screen. I heard the word why over and over. Why, Flynn? The voice became clear. Why would you do this, Flynn? It was Ted Daniels. I rubbed my eyes, making out the image on the monitor. The video on the screen was grainy footage of someone in a black ski mask flipping off the camera. The man was me. A police officer put my hands behind my back, locking handcuffs tightly around my wrists. Flinnegan E. Montgomery, you are being arrested for felony burglary and grand larceny in the fourth degree. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in the court of law. You have the right to have an attorney. If you cannot afford one, one will be appointed to you by the court. Do you understand these rights as they have been told to you? I do, I mumbled. I looked forward and the walls began to disappear. I felt split in two. Good job, Flynn. You did it, Frank said. Part 2. Chapter 12. Asylum. I opened my eyes, and much to my surprise, I wasn't laying on my side or my back. I was sitting on a cold metal table staring at my crossed hands. Imagine, if you will, that you're peering through my eyes. You see what I see, and all you see are your hands in front of you on a metal desk with your fingers interlocked. As I looked up, I saw a woman in front of me, a beautiful blonde woman dressed in white. The room I was in was totally white, maybe 8 by 10 feet. I examined myself. I too was dressed in white. I knew this woman, but how? Where am I? And then I realized it. The woman in front of me was Lola. Lola, what are you doing here? I'm not Lola Flynn, she replied. My name is... What the hell are you talking about, Lola? Why are you dressed that way? Where are we? I began to panic. One minute I was being arrested, and the next I'm in a white room with... Dr. Olivia Cross, she said, and you, Flynn, are at the Mayberry Psychiatric Hospital. I stood up as quickly as possible, launching the examination table against the wall. Pieces of drywall fell to the floor. This doesn't make sense, Lola. Why are you saying this? Flynn, we've been here before, Olivia said, rising calmly to her feet. I want out right now. Where's Lola? Where's... Calm down, please, she said, as two men also dressed in white entered the room and grabbed me by my arms. Please be careful with him, Olivia told them.
Get the fuck off me! What's happening? Lola, please! Why are you doing this?
I said, flailing my arms.
Don't fight it,
one of the men said just as my elbow collided with his nose. Blood was everywhere.
No, please, Olivia yelled. Be careful with him.
The enraged man picked me up, slamming me on the metal table. The searing pain in my skull was a harsh realization. This wasn't another one of my daydreams. This was really happening. And just then, I felt a prick from a needle in my ass. Everything began to fade. I was jolted awake by the sound of a mug shattering on the ground.
God damn it, Frank said.
I looked around. I was in the break room.
Now I gotta pick this shit up.
Oh, sorry, dude. Did I wake you?
Hey, guys,
said Kara, who was walking in, dragging her leather boots on the ground.
Guys,
I said. I was coming too.
Yeah, guys. That's what I said, Kara informed me. You and Frank, duh. Anyway, Frank, I just came in here to tell you Ted needs you to help Rachel with something. I can't believe he doesn't know you guys are hooking up, she added with a chuckle.
Okay, thanks, Kara, Frank said. As she left the room, he stared at her ass and said,
Damn, that little Mormon girl is sexy.
Wait a second, I said, still processing the dream I had just had. You and Rachel are dating? Since when? Since you did me the solid of getting her number for me. Did you hit your head or something? Frank asked as he started to walk out.
Nah, I just had a dream, I continued as Frank kept walking almost to the door. I dreamt I was going crazy, but I don't know. You ever have those dreams where it felt so real you weren't sure if...
Look, man, Frank said, I've been there, and I can tell you from first-hand experience, sanity is what you're currently dreaming. Trying to process what he was saying, I couldn't tell what kind of joke he was playing.
Sanity is what I'm currently dreaming, I repeated.
Flynn to aisle 9 for a psychiatric evaluation, said a voice over the Muldoon's intercom.
Your eyes wide crazy, Flynn.
What the fuck are you talking about? I said, starting to feel that all too familiar tightness in my chest.
You can't leave, Flynn. The supermarket is my home. It's our home. And if you let this bitch doctor back in, it's over. Bye-bye. And I can't have that now, can I?
Was I in the supermarket or was I in a hospital? Was I a character inside of some book? Was I some asshole on a typewriter writing my own life, solely for the entertainment of readers, solely for self-validation, self-preservation, self-worth? Was I just some creative who was destroying my life for accolades and achievements?
I won't stop until we're together again like old times. I need you to believe in me. I need you to believe in me so I can live.
Suddenly, the floor was made of wax, melting by the second. I was drowning in the tiles, struggling with every breath, using all my might to stay afloat until...
I awoke, unable to move, held down in a bed by leather restraints. The room was dark, yet familiar. As I looked around, tears fell from my eyes.
What the fuck is happening to me?
I cried. I was alone, and the clock said 4:17 a.m. I drifted off into sleep, or delusion, or whatever was to become of my weary mind. In that moment, I let go of everything, and then all of it came back. I woke in the same bed, but the restraints were gone. The lights were on, the clock read 7:14 a.m. When I opened my eyes, I could see Lola, or rather, Olivia Cross.
Do you know where you are? She asked.
The nut house, I replied. She laughed.
How do you feel, Flynn?
I feel okay, but I have a lot of questions.
I'll tell you everything after breakfast. Get yourself something to eat. Let's meet in my office after, she said with a smile, putting her hand over mine in a very comforting way.
As I made my way toward the cafeteria, I walked past a man clutching a cup of coffee. He was mumbling to himself, staring at a wall.
Coffee, 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 he said.
He was the same man from the supermarket, the one I would see every day. Joe. I walked around the place. It wasn't what I imagined a nut house to be like. Instead of it being full of crazy patients rocking back and forth, screaming and drooling over themselves. It was actually pretty quiet. The part I was in looked like a freshman dorm common area. Patients were reading.